A bunch of our people are gone to family camp today, and so I've compacted the class a little bit. I hope you don't mind. Turn it up a bit. There we go. So we can have a little bit of discussion. I see signals here and there. What does that mean? Okay, are we okay? Last week, now we got it. Last week when we left, we were talking about Philip and the eunuch. Remember that? And the eunuch's riding along in his chariot reading from the book of Isaiah. And we asked the question, where did he get a copy of Isaiah? Did any of you figure out which answer was correct in the multiple choice or make up your own answer? Now he's a Gentile, Ethiopian, headed back to Africa. He's the minister of finance for the queen of Ethiopia. What's her name? I don't remember the name, but it's given in Acts, so 8th chapter, I think it is, in the 8th chapter of Acts. What's he doing with a book? Where did he get? Did he rob a synagogue and take a scroll back with him? Remember that scroll, Isaiah, was the one Jesus read from in Nazareth. Remember, and those scrolls were kept in the synagogues, and they were sacred. And so, how did he get a copy of it? Well, we had talked about the Septuagint, which was the translation of the Bible, the Hebrew Bible, including Isaiah, into Greek. And that's probably what he was reading, was the Greek translation of the Hebrew Bible, and particularly the scroll of Isaiah. So how did he get hold of one? Did any of you have any revelations about that as to okay, we talked about that a couple of weeks ago. That was in 285 BC. Now some of the Old Testament, that's when the Torah was translated. Scholars think some of the others were translated in that same century, they were translated into Greek, because Greek was the common language of the world, like English is today. And so if you were doing business, or I'm sure there were people that couldn't speak Greek, but if you were anybody doing international business particularly, you would speak Greek. You would have to know Greek in order to do business. And so that's probably what he was reading, and from the quotation that he gave in there, that seems to be the case. Now, where did he get a copy? And any of you have any ideas about? We're talking about the spread of the Bible in New Testament times, and this is New Testament times. The Old Testament Hebrew Bible was being spread throughout the world, because there were Jews everywhere, and many of them no longer spoke Hebrew or even Aramaic. They were speaking Greek. That was the modern language. And many of the places in the world, particularly Alexandria, and we'll talk about that a little bit next week, but there were lots of Jews in the big cities everywhere around the Roman world, and they had the Greek version of the Hebrew Bible, because Hebrew was kind of a forgotten language for many people. So it had become common, and apparently it was being distributed as individual books. Now, can you figure out from that? He had been where? He had been to Jerusalem to do what? Celebrate? It's what time of the year and all it is. He'd been to Passover, apparently. And now he's reading this passage in the book of Isaiah that describes what? 53rd chapter of Isaiah. Remember what the topic is there? The suffering servant. All of the things that Jesus went through when he gave his life as a sacrifice for sin. And it's clearly expressed there. And what was his question? He asked, who's the prophet talking about, himself or somebody else? And what did Philip do? He began at that scripture and preached to him about Jesus. That's right. Well, did you figure out where he got his copy? Yeah, I don't know where he got his copy. We don't know, but you can infer some things here. Okay, I want to tell you where most likely he got his copy. Let me ask you a related question. We are a big international community here in Houston. We're not in Houston, of course, but we're close to Houston. Now, when everybody comes flocking into Houston for a big, let's say a sports event, what do the businessmen of Houston do? Let's say we hold the World Series some year, and there are a couple of teams that are going to play for the championship. And so what do the merchants gear up for? There's a big influx of people. What are they going to do? They're going to come, and they're going to spend a lot of money. They're going to buy souvenirs, okay? T-shirt people, that's their big opportunity, isn't it, for the sports, the teams. And not only the two teams that are playing, they'll sell a lot of T-shirts for your favorite team that didn't quite make the grade. And so they don't miss a chance to make a buck, do they? Do you suppose Jewish merchants ever thought about that? Oh, yeah. I think they did. And when 100, 200,000 people flock to Jerusalem that's a religious event, okay? The two times a year, they had a big influx of people at the time of the Passover and the time of the Day of Atonement in the fall and the Festival of the Booths. So the merchants would gear up, and they're going to sell them stuff, aren't they? And particularly now they had the Septuagint. They didn't sell them the whole Bible. They just sell one book or the other. And some of the books were pretty popular, and I think Isaiah was one of those. And I suspect he bought it from a street merchant, I would guess. That's the most likely place where he would get that and probably pay a tidy sum for Isaiah. You could get one of the Psalms or you could get some of King David's or Solomon's wisdom, for example. Not so expensive. You buy Isaiah, you bought a big book, and that may be pretty costly. But after all, this guy's got money, doesn't he? He's the minister of finance of a large country. So anyway, I just wanted to point that out. We aren't told specifically about this sort of thing, but it's likely that God was pleased with the fact that his word was being spread throughout the world, right? I think he would bless any merchant that's selling the Bible to people, even if he's selling and making some money at it. So the Bible's being spread. The Greek version of the Hebrew Bible, the Old Testament, is being spread throughout the world. Now, it was up until the time of Christ, it was in the form of scrolls. But at about the time of Christ, it became books as we know it. And the transition was pretty fast because the advantage of a book over a scroll was really obvious. And we're going to talk about that this morning. So we saw, and incidentally I learned that the passage over in, where was it, Luke 4, where Jesus unrolled the scroll and rolled it back up and handed it to the attendant, that's probably right. But there are some we want to argue that even there it wasn't a scroll. He opened the book and that's the translation you'll find, I think, in the new NIV. I'm not sure. But some of the newer translations make that change, partly just to make it familiar to the reader that we work with books. We don't work with scrolls. But the handout I gave you today gives you the Wikipedia approach. We've talked about Wikipedia before. It's an online encyclopedia, and it's pretty accurate in recording what everybody has said about a given subject. It doesn't make any discrimination between what's more likely and what's less likely. It's just information. And so keep that in mind as you read that. But this is a pretty good summary of the transition from scrolls you see in the lower right-hand corner of the page. And that's a scroll, a vertical scroll. We didn't show that in some of the other pictures. Scrolls work that way as well as horizontal. They could be pages in a horizontal scroll, or you turn it this way and you unroll it consecutively here. A scroll is a sequential access, what we call serial access in devices that have to do with computers, okay? You got to unroll the scroll from the start, and you got to work your way through the whole thing to see everything that's in it. Whereas a book has the advantage that it's a random access. Did you ever think about that? That you can open a book anywhere, and you can stop. You don't have to start at the beginning again. I remember the old joke in the Feber McGee and Molly programs years ago. Anybody know who Feber McGee and Molly is? And where the guy who was selling stuff door to door, when they interrupted him and he had to start his spiel over again, he went back to the first and worked his way all the way through. And he couldn't start in the middle of his spiels for some reason. He had it memorized from the beginning. Well, that's kind of how scrolls work. But books are random access. That's a big, big, big advantage. And the other advantage of books is that they lay flat. And so you can set them on a shelf somewhere. Scrolls were kind of difficult to work with and hard to protect. They didn't have cardboard tubes like we have now that you could stick a scroll in and protect it. They wrapped it in something to keep it, but you had to be careful with it or it would get torn and disrupted and have to be replaced. So you can read this account, and we're going to go through this pictorially on the slides this morning. And see how you get from scroll to book. And it at first glance, the material on a scroll transferred into a book seems like a simple process, but it wasn't. There were a number of things that were tried that didn't work very well, that sort of worked, but weren't very satisfactory. And once we got to the book, the making of the book is one of the three major advances in written word. I mean, the first big advance was writing, of course, to take words that are spoken and represent them on a piece of paper or a piece of parchment. The second one was making the material available in random access in a book. And what was the third big advantage? The printing press, that's right. And so those things made books ubiquitous. Everywhere in the world, there are books everywhere you go. And you don't have to be rich to build yourself a library of 1,000 books or 10,000 books. And libraries are chock full of stuff. Well, we remember when, as we were talking about in previous lessons about the Septuagint, that was the idea of the Egyptian king was to collect all the books in the world in a library. And so they were interested in that sort of thing. And it would be much easier to collect books, as we know them, in a library than it would be to collect scrolls in a library. Scrolls would take up a lot of space, be much more fragile, and difficult to maintain. But they were working with scrolls in 285 B.C. Now, in the time of Christ, books were taking over. We're going to see how that happened. Now, you can take a scroll, as it is in the top part there. There's 3.5 pages or so. You can separate the pages. And then, but in a scroll, you're only writing on one side of the paper or the parchment. Now, the parchment is made out of animal skins, sheep or goats. We talked about that. You only write on one side. You could flip it over, flip the scroll over, and write some more on the back side. But again, it's sequential access, and what's on the front side doesn't relate to what's on the back side necessarily. Well, if you cut the pages apart, as we've done in the picture here, you could write on both sides of the page. You could write on the front side, flip it over, continue your story on the back side, then go to the front side of the next page, the way it is in our books. But how are you going to join the pages together in a reasonable way? And that turned out to be quite a puzzle. We can see that you can make a joint in the pages by sewing two pages together. That red ellipse shows where in the Isaiah scroll two sets of parchment were joined together with a slight overlap to make a seam, and sewing along the seam to join the two together. But that's not going to help you in putting pages together to make a book. Well, it occurred to somebody that you could take a long scroll, and I have one here, sort of, written on one side, okay? You recognize the script, of course. And so you can fold it in such a way, like a fan fold, as in the middle diagram there. Fold it first one way and then the other, like that. And now you have the unwritten sides back to back. So if you glue those together, and you glue these together, and you glue the next two together, you have pages in something that you can flatten. And the writing is on front and back. You can flatten the thing and put it in some kind of cover, and make a book, as in the lower right-hand side. All of the pages are double because we've glued the unwritten sides of the page together. That's what those arrows represent up there. But you're kind of wasting the back side of the page, aren't you? You're not gaining anything in surface area doing that. But now you have a book with pages that can be taken apart like that. And so, but it has a weakness to it. In the red circle, you'll see what we're talking about. The joint between the two parts of a book, if you hold it in your hand, is a single page, right? Single page that's been creased. And when you crease a page of papyrus paper or animal skin, eventually that wears in two, and the book is held together by a single seam like that. So that is not very stable in the long term above a scroll, but it does give you the random access, so you can turn to different pages. If you fold it up that way, you can make a kind of a book. And they thought about how can we do that more efficiently so that we can use both sides of our paper instead of wasting the blank sides, just gluing them together. And the answer was a choir. Now, choir is spelled with a Q, okay? The kind where you sing songs is spelled how? C-H. And this is spelled Q-U-I-R-E. C-H-O-I-R or I-O-R, I guess it is. I always get that one backwards. It's a gathering of pages. Now you see what they've done? You take a page, you fold it in half, and you stack these pages together, and you have at the seam down here, you'll have the thickness of maybe four pages there, won't you? So this is a quire of four pages of what does it say? Four. Can't read. Yeah, eight leaves. Four double pages stacked together. Eight leaves are 16 front and backs. See, now you, at the juncture where it's folded, you've got strength in multiplication of the papers. So there's four instead of just one at the junction there. So that's a choir. Now, a choir can be a gathering of singers if it's spelled C-H-O-I-R, or it can be a gathering of folded paper if it's spelled Q-U-I-R-E. The reason why I'm telling you this, and I'm going to have to repeat it next week because half of our class has gone to family camp, but this is really an important feature of the books that we're going to talk about. Let's see how you put a book together with choirs. These are choirs held in a hand. There's 11 of them, and it looks like they're probably four pages or eight pages like we've talked about here, or 16 sides to each choir. And if you can tie all of those together on the left-hand side, you can easily then make a book of hundreds of pages, right? And your songbook is made that way. A good quality book is made out of choirs, Q-U-I-R-E. And I'm going to talk about choirs because the manuscripts of the New Testament are built out of choirs. And you can see how the scribe was planning to put the book together by the way in which he assembled his materials. And two of the major arguments about the uniqueness of the Codex W has to do with the assembly of the choirs. And so you got to understand this to understand the evidence. The people that evaluate manuscripts tend to look largely at the print and trying to decide how many different scribes were involved in putting it together. And they look at the paper and they do things like that, but they've ignored some really interesting clues in Codex W. They give you the information, but they don't interpret it. We're going to put an interpretation on it in this class. Codex W, I think, is indeed a first century manuscript of the Gospels. And so that attacks the argument that we posed at the beginning, that the skeptic says the gospel. Here we go. The Gospels were transmitted orally for the first 200 or 300 years, and then somebody decided what the story ought to be. That's not the case. The story was written down from the start, and by the AD 60s, these scribes were busy transcribing this primary account that was written by the authors Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. So here's a gathering of choirs. A choir is a gathering of pages, and here's a gathering of choirs. Let's see how you put that into a book. You've got to attach all of the folded edges together somehow. You can see that, so that the book pages can be easily accessed without being torn or loosened from their base. All right. You tie them together. Now, the books that we're going to talk about, the manuscripts of the New Testament, are tied but not glued necessarily. To make a really stable book, you've got to have a good quality adhesive as well. They didn't have that at the start of things here. They had some glues. Most of them are water-based and so difficult to make them permanent. Elmer wasn't there to make a glue for them. So here's what you do. You tie them together with with thread or cord of some sort. And you can see that the row of strings here come out of holes in the choir, and you thread your string through that hole, run it down the gully here between the pages, and come out another hole at the other end, and tie it in to the assembly of choirs that are being tied together that way. And you can make a huge book this way. These are atlases that are put together, and you can see there's a whole bunch of choirs assembled, and large choirs. The Bibles, the manuscripts we're talking about are largely 8-page choirs. Some of them go to 10 or 12 pages. It's going to be an even number of pages, of course. They tend, though, to be 4, 8, 16, 32. Why do you suppose that's the case? Well, you realize that when the printer comes to printing the pages on the material, he's got to have a formula to put page 1 on one side, page 2 on the other side, but on that single sheet, it has to be printed as single sheets. Then he's got to go to pages 15 and 16 if it's a 8-page choir. And so you got to keep an even number like that, like 4, 8, 16, 32. It makes it simpler for the printer to figure out where to print particular pages material as he's assembling. I'm cutting out again. Okay. So here you tie them together. And these books, you see there's a tying here, there's a major tying there, and another tying back there, and that book is a huge atlas that runs from here all the way back there. And it's real thick. This is all just one book here. So you can see the possibilities when you do it this way. Now, in modern books, you put a glue on the folded edges that after they're all tied together, and you cover that with a piece of leather or a durable material that needs to be flexible a little bit to adhere this to a covering, and then you stick that onto a spine, which is a rigid material, and of course the Bible, most Bibles are covered in leather, and so the spine is not a wooden spine or a stiff spine. But a lot of books, this is a very stiff material at the back, the spine of the book, and the covers are attached to the spine, and they fold to protect the book. And the width of the spine depends on how many choirs you put together to make it. So that's how you make a codex. Now, the word codex is a modern term. Codex doesn't occur in the Bible. Book occurs in the Bible, and the word applies both to scrolls and books, so we don't get much help there with the word biblion or biblios. That's from which we get our word Bible. But nonetheless, we will talk about Codex W, Codex 01, 02, 03, Codex Sinaiticus, Codex Alexandrinus, Codex Vaticanus. Those are the three big codices, and that's the plural of codex is codices. Those are the three big ones that have been around for several hundred years, and from which the King James Bible was translated largely out of the Alexandrinus codex. So when we talk about a codex, we're talking about a book, and it's It's not particularly complicated from the standpoint of what the words mean, but how to make a book has been a complicated thing. And it's only in modern times when they got really serious about printing lots and lots of books with the printing press that they had to develop automated procedures or use something like Henry Ford assembling a car, have an assembly line to make books. Because when you're making books for publication, how many do you make? You might make a printing of 200,000 books. That's a big order, isn't it? And it's a complicated process. So they make it as automated as they can, but they still have to assemble the quires by hand. I don't think there's an automated robot system that will do that. But the rest of it, they can pretty well automate. And, of course, the printing press does a lot of that. Any questions? Did I skip over something that's important to you? Do you know what I'm talking about when I say acquire? Because the Codex W is put together with simple quires of 8 pages, 4 folded pages, most of the time. And incidentally, that's why at the back end of a book, you often find a bunch of blank pages. They were using quires of a certain size, and they ran out of book before they ran out of paper, so once it had been assembled. And so that happens. You got blank pages at the end, and that's sometimes labeled notes or something, so you can write on it if you want to. Books tended to be made out of animal parchment. Sheepskin, goatskin. That was much more durable than papyrus. Okay? But papyrus to the ancients in New Testament times was pretty much like our use of paperbacks. Okay? Paperback books are not as well built as a quality book like your songbooks are or your Bible. They're put together more rapidly. And we make paperback books because we have adhesives that work well to attach a quarter inch of the edge of the page. Under pressure, you can put a whole bunch of pages together and press them in a way that you don't have the glue adhering between the pages, because if it runs up in between two pages and sticks them together, you can't read the book, can you? So there are problems about it. You've got to have the right adhesives, which they did not have in early days. Okay, the books we're going to talk about, particularly Codex W, let me give you a brief description of it, and in a couple of weeks we're going to look at it in detail. The covers on this codex were made out of wood, and so the assembly of the whole thing was with the threads that hold the quires together. They simply sewed through holes in the wooden covers and tied the whole thing together so that the wooden covers protected. That was the main purpose, was to protect the paper or the parchment on which the book was written. And actually, that works really well because it cuts the exposure of the ink to the air, right? The ink is made, basically it's an iron ink. Black was what they used. But if the air gets to iron-containing ink, what happens to it? It oxidizes and it forms what? Rust. And that turns the ink from black to brown. And the brown ink is not as easy to see, and it tends with time to fade if it's exposed to air. So a book that was carefully sandwiched between two solid wooden plates, like the codex we're looking at, and then wrapped carefully with cloth wrappings, and then buried in the sand in a dry environment, that's almost ideal. And that's where Codex W, that was Codex W's fate. It was probably used for about 100 years and then retired and ultimately buried. And who would bury a codex in the sand? Well, the Jews would do that. Why? Well, that was how they handled their scrolls, remember? That's where Dead Sea Scrolls got buried in a cave, and a lot of the fragments in some of those caves indicate that it was really a burial place for the scrolls. And they buried it. It was sacred. They buried it just like they would bury a body. And so whoever buried Codex W, they wrapped it up and buried it in the sand in a region near the Giza pyramids where there's no rain. There's water to water the fields near the Nile River, but it doesn't rain much. And so this was well protected and lasted for 2,000 years until it was dug up by a man who was hunting for treasure. And Egypt has a history of that, don't they? They've had treasure hunters looking through stuff for years and years looking for buried gold or buried valuables of one sort or another, particularly because things were buried with the bodies of people who had been buried there. So, here's a scroll that was uncovered, and we're going to talk about that scroll, and you're going to need to know about choirs in order to understand the evidence for its originality. Okay. We're taking this slow and easy, and I got through quickly today for some reason, and because you're all attentive. Do you have any questions about this, or do you have any discussions? The Hebrew version. The Alexandria book, okay, the codex, was it includes the Old Testament, but it includes only the Greek translation, the Septuagint. It agrees with the Septuagint from Genesis all the way through. And so to try to translate out of the Hebrew into Greek was difficult. And it took someone who knew both languages, and that was done unevenly in making the Septuagint, as we talked about it, because it was done by 72 different people over a period of over 2 months, and they each worked on different parts of the Old Testament and came up with some parts of it, particularly the Torah, that's Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, done very well. But many of the prophets and some of the history of the Old Testament was a varying accuracy in terms of the translation. It doesn't mean, as the material I gave you last week, it doesn't mean that they intended to make mistakes, but it's just that they did. Some of the translators weren't quite up to par and lacking in the skills that they needed to make a good translation. Now, the Greek that it was translated into is the common Greek that was spoken. Really, you'd call it street Greek, I guess. It was what people used. It wasn't classical Greek. And we're going to look at one of the books of the New Testament, of the Gospels, that is classical. That's very good Greek, and that's the Greek that Luke used. Luke was a well-educated doctor, and he had to speak good Greek because all of the information to become a doctor was in Greek, and so he used excellent Greek in his book, and we'll talk about that. We'll look at the Codex of Greek's translation very carefully. Okay. That's right.
So with the addition of the effort to make the book itself, is it true that it took longer even to do the book than it did the scroll?
I don't think so. The book of Codex W was tied together, and copies were made from it. We know that, and I'll show you how we know that. So they just simply untied it and took it apart to copy it and made the pages fit and then reassemble a new book when they got through with it. I think the mathematics of it was all involved in using those same pages to make new pages. So you didn't necessarily copy consecutive parts of the scripture. What you may start at on page 3, and then when you go to the right-hand side, you take the choir apart, and you go to the right-hand side of the choir, and you're on page 7 or something. And so the scribe simply has to work with copying what he sees. He doesn't have to understand it necessarily. But you remember we looked at the rules of the scribe. He takes pains to make sure that he's done it right. And we have some of those indications in the Codex, particularly in the Codex W, that it was a Jewish scribe who was doing this. And his training would have made him continue to do it that way, even though he was copying Greek. But when you get to 200 or 300 years down the line and you've got Gentile scribes doing the work, they may not be as careful about it as the tradition of the Jewish scribe. And we'll talk about that a little bit when we talk about the individual books. I hate to take it piecemeal like this, but we've got to look at it carefully a bit at a time, so that we understand the evidence that we're going to look at. We have a case in one of the books of the first choir of the book has an extra page glued to it at the edges. They were able to glue a pre-existing page onto an 8-page choir. And you wonder, why in the world did they do that? Well, we'll talk about that when we get there, and to understand what the situation was. Now you know what a choir is. You know that's there's got to be a reason for doing something like that. And we'll talk about the possible reasons. And we've got a case where the scribe is recopying part of a book. Evidently had been damaged or something, and he's trying to make it come out even like the old one did. And so, yes, he leaves some spaces along the way, and he makes a mistake in the process, and we'll look at that. So there are things that have to do with the structure of the book that tell us some things about how it was made and who was making it. Well, now we've used up all of our class period, and I'll give you the last 2 or 3 minutes to visit or something. Say hello to people around you. Thank you very much.